Welcome to my presentation on Microsoft F#, the new language. I guess you're all interested in F#, otherwise you wouldn't be here. There's a little bit of information about myself right here. My name is Oliver Sturm. I work for a company called Developer Express, and I'm just generally interested in programming languages and the things you can do with them. You know, C# is, well, I got a Microsoft MVP award for C#. F# is, of course, the newest thing that I'm interested in. I always like to stress this thing here at the bottom. Please do send me emails if you have questions about the session or you just want to tell me that it was right or maybe extremely bad. I don't care. I don't get enough emails. So, you know, keep them coming. Some spam, thank you very much, yes. Great. There's also other contact information on here. You can get all the slides and samples after the session. So, you know, get back to me any way you want. If you have any questions or you would like to discuss something with me. Right, so this is my rough agenda for today. We'll have to see how far we get. We've got an hour and a few minutes, basically. Maybe leave most of the questions to the end better so we can get through more of the content. I'm going to be around both days here at the conference, so if you can find me somewhere, you can also ask your questions afterwards. My introduction is, what is F# and why is it interesting? So, you know, why do we even care creating a new language? Don't we have enough languages already on the .NET platform, really? And then I'm going to go into an introduction to the language itself and show you the basic syntax and everything, what it looks like, what things you can do. Some concepts that are probably going to be new to most of you. But let me ask you, has anybody played with F# so far? Hands? A few? In great depth or not so much? No depth? A little bit in the back? Okay, well, those are not the most of you. Okay, great. And who's got a background in functional programming languages, like maybe from university, Lisp, Haskell, Scheme? Okay, just very few as well. Okay, so for the most of you, some of those ideas are going to be pretty new. So I'm going to explain some of the ideas behind, you know, partial application, for instance. Not going into too much depth, I suppose, because it's going to be mainly about code in F#. And finally, I've got this little example at the end where I would like to show you just quickly how you can actually do those object-oriented things and also work with standard classes from the .NET framework, which is basically one of the reasons why having a functional language on the .NET platform as opposed to all those other functional languages that have been around in the world for a long time, you know, is an interesting thing because you can make use of all these things that are in the .NET framework. And I just want to show you how to do that as well. All right. So, what is F#? F# is a .NET language. It has, well, almost full Visual Studio integration. At this time, we're not 100% there. I'm just jumping ahead to my last point right here. Microsoft is incorporating F# as a language in Visual Studio 2010. And for the first time in the latest beta that has just been released a few days ago to MSDN, F# is actually included. The integration isn't full yet. They are still working on some of the stuff that will allow you to create full-blown Windows Forms applications from templates and all these things. But you do have IntelliSense and syntax highlighting and everything in the editor, and you can actually target all the different project types that Visual Studio allows you to target. So you can create Windows Forms applications and web applications and WPF applications and so on. It's just a little more manual work now because the templates aren't there yet. Right? That's been the state for a while. The F# has been in development at Microsoft Research in Cambridge for about 6 or 7 years, I believe. And so it is a pretty stable language that some people have been using for a long time as well. Syntactically, it is based on a hybrid functional object-oriented language called OCaml, Object Camel, which in turn is based on Camel, which in turn is based on ML. So there's a long history in the functional, so on the functional side of things, so to speak, where this language comes from. It is a type-safe language. That's quite important to mention because if you just look at F# code that you read somewhere, you might get the impression that it doesn't really use types a lot. So maybe it's dynamic, right? No, it's not. It's not dynamic. It is a typed language, a statically typed language, I should say, to be clear. But it uses type inference a lot. which is why you don't typically have to use types explicitly in very many cases. The compiler, and also the IDE actually, just goes and infers the types, like you're familiar from C-sharp with the var keyword and some of the things you can do with lambda expressions, for instance, where you don't have to mention the types either. They are inferred. F-sharp does this as well, but it does it in a much more complete way. So you can actually just not use types in almost any places. You always have the option to do it. So if you say type inference is kind of scary to me, which some people think, you know, not seeing the types that are in there is not something everybody likes. If that's what you think, then you can use types, right? I'm not saying you can't. Anyway, that's the type safety thing is a little important to me because a lot of the sample code you read just doesn't use types. And people walk around thinking, hey, it's a dynamic language. No. It's based on the CLR, not the DLR. It is a statically typed language. It's hybrid, which means that it supports functional as well as object-oriented paradigms. It even supports some other stuff like, for instance, metaprogramming functionality that you don't have in any other .NET languages, well, with the exception maybe of some of the new DLR languages, right? Ruby has got some metaprogramming support, but the traditional statically typed languages on the .NET framework did not have that sort of functionality. Right. What do you need to get started? At this point, you can get a download of F-sharp, just like you could basically over the past few years, that will install in an old version of Visual Studio, so to speak. 2008, 2005, I don't know about 2003, they might have dropped that. No, actually, that's a stupid idea for myself anyway, because they need generics. So from .NET 2 onwards, basically, that would be where you can use these separate downloads. And you can also use the beta 1 of Visual Studio 2010. I'm actually going to be using 2008 here in this presentation today because I haven't had time yet, basically, to migrate my samples to the, well, slight changes that are in beta 1. So my last point is kind of important. They are obviously finalizing a lot of the loose ends, so to speak, that have been in F-sharp for a long time in order to get to the release of 2010. So if you're on that version, you should expect things to change quite regularly to accommodate those changes. Why is it interesting? Well, there are a number of different, you know, places where you can come from when you come to F-sharp. It is a test bed, or it has been a test bed in the past, for features that make it into the mainstream languages and also the mainstream .NET framework. One example is generics itself. Don Tsang, the guy I'm mentioning up here, is the guy behind F-sharp at Microsoft Research, and he came along with the original idea, as far as, you know, the anecdote goes, that they would have to have generics in order to do all this fancy type inference stuff that F-sharp does, that functional languages, some of them do, and that's why, allegedly, they came into the mainstream CLR and the .NET framework and so on. Link is another example, not with direct reference to F-sharp, but as an API that has a lot of functional influences. So, you know, the ideas just keep creeping into the mainstream. And there are some more examples with .NET 4, where, for instance, we have a tuple data type, and an option data type, and the lazy data type, and all these things come directly from F-sharp in these cases. Right, so it's migrated all the time. So one reason to look at F-sharp, even if you might not be using it, is just to see, you know, what other ideas are out there? What might be the next big thing on my platform, even if you're using C-sharp, maybe? The other thing is, of course, functional programming. That's what this FP thing right there means. The syntactic elements that are in F-sharp make it much easier to use functional approaches. Why would you use functional approaches? Many reasons, but the most important one recently has been the concurrency issue. Programming for parallelism, right? That's a very important thing for a lot of people these days. In .NET 4, we have the parallel extensions that allow you to you know, basically create threads and tasks that run in parallel very easily. But only on the technical side of things, as I would like to say. So if you need to structure your application in such a way that concurrency becomes easy to apply, you will have to use some approach to do that, and functional programming offers some of those answers you need if you're trying to do this. You can do functional programming in a lot of languages. It doesn't have to be a functional language, so to speak, but it is just so much easier if you've got support for these things in the syntax baked into the language, basically. Well, and finally, there is just stuff that goes beyond C#. I should actually say in here, you can't really do anything with C# that you cannot do with F# as well. So, if you're a C# programmer and you always look for the best tool to use, basically, then F# might be something to look at for you just for that reason alone. Okay? That's where we are today. There's C#, everything you can do, and there's also lots of stuff on top. Well, just a bit of a summary. I don't want to go into all those points, but things that people find interesting about F# obviously lead to different conclusions. So there are, you know, lots of people in the financial sectors, in the academics, that just find the functional programming part very, very interesting. Microsoft has the idea of also gaining some mind share in the academic sector, in the financial industry, and so on, by having a language that allows people to use those very clean approaches, right? In universities, functional or languages from Microsoft are not being used at the moment to teach students functional programming. Well, obviously, because there wasn't any such language. Now there is, and that's why it's interesting from Microsoft's perspective. But, as I said before, it can be interesting to anyone. If you're a little flexible, maybe, and you just want the most powerful thing to use to create .NET applications, F# might be for you just for that reason. Right, let me show you what it looks like. Oops, I hit the wrong button there. Some language elements. First, I'm using this interactive environment. It's a console application that comes with the F# distribution, and that just allows you to test some F# code. They call this sort of thing a REPL. It's a thingy processing loop or something like that. I forget what REPL really means, to be quite honest. A lot of programming languages have it, and it allows for this, you know, just trial and error sort of programming style. So you go in there and you just test something out very quickly, and if it works well, you copy it over into your code in Visual Studio. There's even a version of the REPL, which I'm not using here because of the screen resolution, that works as a tool window within Visual Studio, right? Pretty nice. Not so good for presentations because that's just not that much room on the screen, right? But that's also what you can do. So, first statement in F#, I'm assigning a value. I'm going to call this thing A, and it's got a value 10. I type let A equals 10, simple, right? And I need a double semicolon right there, but that's not a language thing. It's a feature basically of the interactive environment. So I have to terminate my statements in the interactive environment using this double semicolon. Within the code that I'll show you later in Visual Studio, you won't see that, right? Hit return, and the interactive environment says, all right, I've got a value called A, and it's of type int. So that's type inference for you, obviously. The value 10 is deemed to be an int, which is probably quite correct. Of course, I could do, you know, let f equals 10.5, maybe, like this, and that's going to be a float, right? So the type is inferred from the value that I assign, pretty much similar to C# at this point, just the syntax is different. I'm calling this thing a value as opposed to a variable, and the reason won't maybe surprise you. The reason is it's not variable. It doesn't change, right? It can't change. Immutable data. Data that does not change once you've assigned it is one of the core concepts of functional programming languages, or many at least of them. And in F#, values are immutable by default. There are several different ways of making values mutable. So if you want to store mutable data, it's quite easy in F#, which is because it is a hybrid language and it interacts with the .NET framework, where you do need that functionality, of course. In some true, pure functional languages, you really can't change values, like in Haskell, for instance. Right? There's no such thing as a changing variable in Haskell. So F# is a little more flexible because of the way it interacts with the different worlds of programming out there. Right, so if I go, just as an example, and say, let's change the A thing to say A equals 20, what is it going to do? Well, it says, the return value of this operation is a bool and it's false. So what it does, in fact, is it checks whether A is 20 or not, right? So you don't have these two different operators for assignment and equality check. Or in fact, you do. Maybe I shouldn't say it quite like that, right? But in C sharp, just to take that step back, you do have a single equals for assignment and a double equals sign for equality check, right? Because it is possible to assign a variable a different value. In F sharp, you can't do it, or at least not with this thing right there. So that's why they say, all right, if it's being used like this, that is an equality check, quite obviously. There's a question, please. Let A equals 50. Well, oh, that's a good question, actually. What happens if I say let A equals 50? The answer is, in this interactive environment, the environment is just going to rebind my variable. So basically, it's now created a new instance of the same thing. I was calling it a variable, right? I should be calling it a value still, right? It is rebinding my value. Within the language itself, you couldn't be doing that because you've got a sequence of statements, whereas the interactive environment basically uses sort of a new context, if you want to, for each statement you execute, right? So that's what happens right here. Now, there are ways of making values mutable. For instance, you can go let mutable b equals 10, like this. That's one way of doing it. Now I've got a mutable b, as it says, still of type int. And I can now go and use a special operator, which is this arrow pointing left, to assign a new value to b. Okay? That's how that works. This operator is specific to mutable data types. So anytime you use the mutable keyword, like it's up there, okay, that's when you can use this arrow pointing left to assign a new value. Now, interesting thing is the return value of the operation where it says val it colon unit. Now, the interactive environment always shows you the return value of the statement that you've just executed. And in this case, the assignment statement itself really doesn't return anything. That is interesting, by the way, because in some languages you can use an assignment statement within, like an if clause, for instance. You could do that in C, for example, right? And so the assignment statement would basically return the value of the assignment. In F sharp, it doesn't return anything. And the name for nothing in F sharp, or the type nothing, is unit, right? It's very similar to void in C-based languages, for instance. So that's what's happening here. Just as an aside, there are other ways of making values mutable. One of them is the so-called ref cells. Just mentioning this, so you've heard it. I think there's a little example in my sample code as well. Just so you know, there are different ways. They have slight differences in the way they are handled internally. For instance, you cannot use mutable values in a closure, for those of you who are entirely familiar with what a closure is, right? So you've heard it, remember it. If you stumble upon it, you can say, Oliver Sturm said that. Right. So what else do we need apart from values? We need functions, right? We want to do stuff with our values, of course. Now, creating a function in F-sharp is just as easy as creating a value because a function is basically a value itself. Now, if I want to function a very simple one that I'm going to call square, I just type let square x equals x times x, like this. And there we go. I've got a function. Now, the function is called square, and it has a parameter that is called x. And its return value is simply listed after the equals sign, and the return value is x times x. So I'm squaring this value, obviously, right, by multiplying. But I don't need a lot of the syntactic sugar that is around these types of assignments or this type of code, basically creating functions or methods in most other languages. So my function square is basically just another value. I can look at what that value is by just typing square, for instance. And it says, okay, with an interesting syntax, it says this is a function, fun. And it also shows me the type, and the type is this interesting thing with the arrow in the middle. Now, the arrow is basically what you know from C sharp, maybe. In lambda expressions, you use the so-called goes to operator. Right, in C sharp, it's actually equals and then the angle bracket. Here, it's just a single arrow, but it's roughly the same thing. So what this says is, we've got a function here that takes an int as a parameter and also returns an int. That's what this says. Now, every time you see one of these arrows there, you can assume that this is in fact a function, right? So let's see what happens if I have a function that has more than one parameter, for instance, an x and a y. I'm going to call this add, and I'll return x plus y, like this. Now, I've got a function add, and it's got this signature right there. Int goes to int goes to int. It's kind of weird, at the same time understandable, isn't it? Because, well, you take an int, and somehow you take another int, and you return an int, and that's pretty much what the function does, in fact. But it just looks a little weird, because you would assume that somehow these two parameters I'm taking are coupled, right? That's what they are in C-sharp. Now, the reason they're not coupled here is because F-sharp uses so-called curried format functions by default. Now, the curried format idea goes back to a mathematician called Haskell Curry, which is a very lucky incident, by the way, because another guy called Schoenfinkel came up with the same ideas around the same time. So they decided not to call it Schoenfinkelization, which I do appreciate a lot, you know. So, it is called currying. The currying itself is really the process of transferring a function from a format like you know it in C-sharp, where it has a bunch of parameters, into a format where it just takes one parameter at a time, like this one does, right? Now, the advantage of having functions in curried format is that you can perform things like partial application. If to apply a function, first of all, just means to call the function, okay? Now, we haven't actually called these functions very much yet, so let me do that. Let's do square 10, for instance. Just mention the name of the function and the parameter separated by spaces. Parameters are always separated by spaces in F-sharp. Now, I can also do add 10 and 20 like this, right? Okay, and it's going to give me 30. Wonderful. So that means I'm applying these functions. I'm calling them. Now, partial application means I'm applying the function, but I'm not passing in all the parameters at once. So, if I'm only going to call, I mean, obviously on the square, I can't do this because there's just one parameter, right? So that's a bad example. But add has two parameters, so I could just pass in the first one of them. So if I go add 5, this thing, funnily enough, returns me a new function. It's a function, right? We've seen that before. And this new function takes an int parameter and returns an int as well. So I've just passed one parameter and I got back a new function. And that's where this syntax up here makes sense. Let me point this out to you again. Oh, yeah, I got a sliding mouse thing on the console here. Where is it now? There it is. Right? Now, this syntax here basically says, I take an int and I return a function, this whole thing basically, right, that again takes an int and then returns an int. So that's exactly what the signature said. And now I am, in fact, passing in just the one value and I get back another function that takes an int and returns an int. So that's absolutely compatible with the signature of the function that I saw previously. Why is that a good idea? Partial application is one of the different approaches you can use for what is called function construction. So, in functional languages, traditionally, functions were building blocks. So if you're an object-oriented programmer, and you're used to using classes and interfaces and methods, you know, and overloads and all those mechanisms that are in there, to create new things out of existing ones, right? Now, if you're a functional programmer and there are no such things as classes and interfaces and, you know, all these things, what are you going to do? To create new things, you will have to use functions as the building blocks out of which you create other new stuff. And that's what function construction is all about. And partial application is one of the approaches you can use for function construction. Now, say I've got a function that is a very powerful function, like my add function, right? My add function is brilliant. It can add any two things. It's fantastic, right? There are pretty much no restrictions on what two things I can add. Well, it works with an int, so there's a value restriction in there. But I can pass in any two ints, and it does its job. Now, what if your algorithm that you're working on is a little simpler, really, and also a little more specific? And you only ever need to add 5. You don't care about adding all sorts of things. You only want to add 5, right? Like I just did. So, why not create yourself a specialized function that always adds 5? Now, at this point, maybe you're thinking, okay, I'm going to write an overload, right? Well, you would in object-oriented programming. In functional programming, you would instead just go and say, I'm creating myself a new function, and I'm going to call it add 5, and I create it by calling the existing function and passing in 5, right? Like this. And now I've got a new function called add 5, and, you know, since, as we saw before, this is now this other function that has been returned that takes an int and returns an int, and I can now call add 5 and pass in 37, and it's going to give me 42. It always adds 5. Great, isn't it? Is that more confusing or is that more interesting to you? mixing floats and ints and adding? This is now a typed function that is assumed to be working with ints. Right, and that is basically just a default assumption because I was not mentioning any types on my function. So the compiler thought, okay, these are going to be ints by default, so to speak. Right? If you want to add floats, there are two different ways. You can either create a function that actually takes a float parameter by putting a type annotation onto the parameter to say, this is supposed to be a float. Or you can go and change one of your values around or cast it basically to the other type in order to say to the compiler, you know, this is what I really want to do now. So these are from two separate ends basically of the problem, right? So the int thing again is just what the compiler assumes if you don't tell it. The numerical value is typically going to be an int by default. Now, second thing about function construction, right? I can also go and compose functions, which is quite interesting. So let's see. Or let me take one step back. I'm going to show you something slightly different first. But let me create another function. This is called mult for multiply, right? So I've got mult x and y, and it returns the result of multiplying x and y. What a surprise. Now, I can use the so-called piping or chaining operator in F-sharp in order to create a sequence of calls. Consider this little function. For instance, I'm going to do add 15, and then I'm going to do mult 10 and 20, like this, right? This sequence is somewhat interesting because there are suddenly parens in there, which we haven't seen so far, so that's number one. And number two is, they somehow seem to be in the wrong place, right? Coming from a C-sharp or VB perspective or whatever most of you really do. Now, in C-sharp or VB, you would put this like this, add, and then you've got a paren opening, and then you've got mult, and then you've got 10 and 20, maybe like this, right? That's what you would expect to see in any of those imperative languages. Now, the parens in F-sharp are not part of the general format of applying, calling a function. We've already seen them. In C-sharp, for instance, they are. You always have to use parens just in order to call a function. In F-sharp, you don't. Which is why, in this, let me remove this C-sharpy example right here, which is why, in this example, the parens are used to define priority. So, this basically means I'm calling mult first, right? Multiply 10 and 20, and then I pass the result into add as its second parameter, so I'm basically adding 15 to the result of multiplying 10 and 20, which is 200, and that gives me 215, right? So you've got the parens for prioritization in there. There's a question, please.
And stated before, F-sharp is based on academic programming languages.
Mm-hmm.
If I go back to academic programming thoughts, and there's a sequence to multiply goes before adding.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, in this case, if it was based on academic skills, it would say you don't need parentheses because multiply always goes before adding. Is that true?
No. Okay, so the question is, there's normally in mathematics, there's a higher priority in a multiplication operation than there is in an adding operation, so I shouldn't need the parens. No, that's not true, unfortunately, because these are just functions, right? So the compiler doesn't guess, basically, that, you know, because you're performing a multiplication operation, it should have a higher priority than the add. It is true in an actual calculation. So if I'm going to do 15 plus, what is that, 10 times, 20 times 10, doesn't matter, like this. Oops, now I'm mistyping this as well. What is going on? So let's just do this again. 15 plus 10 times 20, semicolon, like this, right? This gives me the right result anyway because it uses the actual mathematical operators. So in that case, yes, F# has the same notion of these things as other languages as well. But the functions add and mult don't have that notion because I just created them myself, right? Now, looking back to this example up here where I've got this train of calls, so to speak, us programmers are typically quite used to the fact that if you look at a large equation in code, you will have to look for the innermost element first and then basically look what that is, because that's going to be calculated first, right? And then go outside and look at the next operation and so on. But it's not logical, right? It's just something that we are used to. Mathematicians are probably used to it as well. Anyway, in F#, there is a way to reverse the sequence. And this looks like this. I could go mult 10, 20, and then use this interesting operator, which is a pipe sign and an angle bracket pointing right, and now go add 15, oops, 15, like this. And that's going to give me the same result. So suddenly, I am, in fact, listing those different operations in the correct order, in the order they are actually executed, which is extremely useful. What happens, in fact, is that the result of the first operation is appended to the parameter list of the second call. So my add 15, add actually takes two parameters, right? So the result of mark 10 and 20 becomes the second parameter to my add function, and that's how I end up calling add 15 and 200, and the total result is 215. Another question, please?
So just going back to the add 15 with the parentheses in mark 10, 20,
okay.
I'm still surprised that it doesn't infer it, because add doesn't take a function of the parameter, it takes ints. So surely then the compiler ought to be able to figure out.
Oh, you mean if I say this, like mult 10, 20, like that?
If you take the parens out, then,
yeah,
then mult becomes the parameter for add, right? And it doesn't take the function, so you have to interpret it the other way.
Well, yeah, but that, no, I think that would be guesswork, you know. So basically what it says if I do this is that it cannot call the add function because there is no add function that takes an integer and a function as a parameter, right?
And so
there might be as well, yes, of course, right? So you could have a conflict, of course. I mean, you're basically saying maybe the compiler should now take the next step and say, all right, if there is no such function, so how about I interpret this a different way and then call mult first, right? So I think, yeah, theoretically you're right, that would be possible, but in other situations maybe it wouldn't, right? So it is a little dangerous, and I guess that might be the reason why it doesn't happen like that by default. There's a question in the back for us.
You also have an operator to insert parameters.
To insert parameters?
Yeah. So if you have a list of three and the middle one is unknown.
I'm not sure I'm understanding you, sorry.
If you want the pipeline thing, you have the mult.
Oh, now I see. You're back on the pipeline thing. Sorry,
so
I was somewhere else in my mind.
You need to use them, right?
No, you can't. The parameter is always appended. Right? The thing that comes out of the pipe, out of the chain, is always appended to the parameter list that you have in there. There are ways, in fact, to turn this around. So, for instance, I could do this. I could create myself an inverse add yx equals add xy, like this. And now suddenly you've got a function that does the same thing but takes the parameters in a different order. Right, so that would allow you to now use the inverse add and suddenly get your parameter appended, but it's now the first parameter, so to speak. See what I mean?
Yeah, but it's still two parameters. Can you write it in logical order when it's more than two parameters? That's basically the question.
Yes. Well, if I've got this example from up here, like this, I could add, you know, if there are several parameters, I would add these in here, and the thing that comes from mult would still be the last one.
Yeah, so if there's one unknown somewhere in the middle, you cannot write it in logical order. That's what you're saying, right?
What do you mean by unknown? I'm not understanding the question.
I have a function that takes an x, a y, and a z. And x and z are known, and y is unknown.
Right. So where would it come from? From the train or the pipe or what?
From the function before it.
So through the train, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I meant previously. So, okay, let's do this, right? We're here to check things out, so let's check things out. So if I've got a function add 3, right, for instance, and this has x, y, and z parameters, So, and I return x plus y plus z, like this. So now I've got a function with 3 parameters. Now, what I would like to do is call mult 1020 and pipe this into add, but in the add I'm going to specify 5, and I want the middle parameter, right? Like right here, this is the one that I want to replace, basically, and then I've got 20 in the back, right? So that's what you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Now, I cannot do this directly with the piping because there's no way of specifying where does the new value go. It always goes at the end. So that's what I meant when I said previously I could do myself a variation of this. Why doesn't this... thank you. So let's say I've got this variation of add 3, right? Add 3 v for variation, right? And this is just going to take x and then z and then y, and then it calls add 3 with x, y, z. Something's wrong with my z key. There we go. Right, so now I've got this variation of the function where the parameter that I'm interested in is the last one. So now I can suddenly say mult 1020 and pipe this into, there we go, into add 3 v, and I'm passing 5 and 20, because those were the two values above that I said I do know, right? And now my last parameter in add 3 v is in fact the one that I was going to replace. So now if I execute this, this will give me the result that I was looking for. Right? So actually, if you do use function construction in a purely functional sense of the word, this would be what you do. It's not too hard because it's basically a line of code that allows you to create this variant function. It might be that in a totally hybrid scenario, like F-sharp is, you would now say, okay, maybe function construction is not what I'm going to use after all, because it might be much easier to create an overload for me, right? For example, I was saying that these mechanisms match, they overlap, right? Because we're looking at two different paradigms with object-oriented and functional programming. And if you're working in a language that supports both, then you have a choice, of course. So, anyway, in a purely functional environment, you really do this. Another question? Yes. Yes. So the question is, can I pass more than one parameter through the pipeline, basically? And the answer is, you cannot really do that. There's always just one value that goes through there. Now, the thing is, in F-sharp, we also have other data types, like, for instance, tuples. I can do this, let t, and I use parens to say, this is a tuple. And that's what I said initially. It's also in .NET 4, by the way, so you'd be able to use these things in other languages as well, although, unfortunately, not quite as easily, because part of the interesting thing in F-sharp is that you have the syntax as well to create these things very easily, right? In other languages, you're going to have to go tuple.create or something like that and pass in the values. Anyway, this allows you to return multiple values from a single function, for instance. Right? So I could now use the tuple, which is one value, so to speak. The type of the tuple is int star int, which means that it's a combined value made up from two int values. And I could use one tuple to pass through a pipeline into another function, and the tuple actually does carry several values in itself, right? Of course, to be more object-oriented, I could just use a class instance in the same way, basically, to pass along several parameters in a combined way. But in reality, these chains are in fact extremely useful for like things like data processing, for instance. Think of Link. You know Link, right? How it works with the innumerable of something and so on. So you've got these operations where you call where and select and you know, whatever other aggregate function maybe that you do. And you always get a result back from one of these functions and you pass it on to the next function. So you have exactly the same sequence of calls that I'm talking about here, right? Just as an example that might make it more familiar for you. Right, so back to my composition example. Composition is basically a more static way of applying the chaining thing. So, if I've got, let's go back to a simple example from above. So if I've got the mullet 10 and 20, pipe to add 15 example once more, right? Like this, 215. Now maybe you want something like this as a static function that you can use, that you can just reuse all the time. And that's easy as well. So let's say I want a function that multiplies by 10 and adds by 15. So I'm going to call it mullet 10 add 15, right? For the fantastic naming convention that I have right here. Isn't that amazing? So I go, this is equal to mullet 10, and I use this double angle bracket operator pointing to the right, and I pass this on into add 15. And I get back a new function called mullet 10 add 15, and if I call this and pass in the 20, I should get my 215 out of it again, right? Why? Quite simply because with composition, which is what this process is called, composing two functions, the mult function that I list first has, I'm passing only one parameter, so there's one parameter outstanding, so to speak, right? Now, this outstanding parameter is going to be the parameter of the result function as well. So the second parameter to mult is now also the parameter to my new mult 10 add 15 function. Same thing, right? Now, the result from mult 10 with whatever I'm passing in eventually is going to be passed into add 15, so to speak. Just like we did with the piping and chaining previously, only now I'm using the compose operator, which means, you know, please fix this, create me a new function out of this total operation. And of course, you know, just with the like with the chaining, it could go on. So I could be more complex by making the chain longer, chaining more things together. Composition is the second of those approaches you can use for function construction. So you've got partial application and composition to use functions as building blocks and create new things from existing ones. Very interesting. Even possible in C#, by the way, just a little more confusing. All right. So at this point, I want to switch back. Well, not here, though. I want to switch back to my code and show you a few more things in here. We've got roughly half an hour to go. Wonderful. So let's see. We've seen most of this stuff at the beginning right here. What is new? There are a few other things in here that I'm not really going to go into, but it's interesting stuff. So if you want to have a look at the samples and slides yourself later on, I left a few things in there just so you can find the odd bit, you know, after the fact, really. I wasn't mentioning this here, which is quite interesting, how to decompose a tuple. I've shown you the tuple, right? The d equals 1020 thing right there. Now, obviously, apart from putting values together into a single element, it's also interesting how you can get back to these things, right? And the answer in functional languages in general is decomposition. And there are several or many different ways in most languages where you can use decomposition. I think I've got a more advanced example down below. So, but this is the simple thing. So I just go let part 1 comma part 2 equals d, where d is my tuple, and now part 1 contains the first value from the tuple, and part 2 contains the second value from the tuple, right? So that's what I meant previously, because having the tuple in .NET 4 is great, it's better than not having it, but at the same time, it's probably not going to be quite as useful in many other languages, because you cannot so easily work with it, right? It's going to be more complicated syntactically to actually make use of these things. One example, why I was stressing initially that having F-sharp is a good idea if you want to do functional programming simply for the syntactic elements that make it very easy for you. The second thing in here are the so-called option types. Now, it starts down here, so I've got this listed the wrong way around, if you will. That's because I wanted to introduce the function first. But let's look at the values first. Now, the option val is assigned to be sum of 5. And option val 2 is assigned to be none. An option value is basically a value that allows you to have a value or not. It's a little bit like a nullable type in C#, right? Now, in functional languages, people never had this notion of null. Null is a very odd thing anyway, to my mind, because, it goes back to the idea that there used to be a special pointer, so to speak, in old C-based languages that just happened to be zero, right? Actually, I think even in C days, that was not true on all platforms. Some platforms had other special values that were not, in fact, zero. But they just went and had a keyword called null, and they always made it point to the right special value on each of the platforms. If you wanted to say, this pointer does not point at anything, you were using this special thing, null. That's where it comes from. And we still got it today, even though there aren't even any pointers in C#, right? So that's very crazy to my mind. In VB, it's called nothing. I like that much better, to be honest. It's not too much that I like very much about VB, quite honestly, but having it called nothing instead of null just makes a lot of sense. Anyway, in functional languages, people had the same problem, basically, having things that sometimes have a value and sometimes they don't. And that's what the option types are for. Another thing, by the way, that's going to come in .NET 4 as well, so you'll be able to use these in other languages as well. In F#, they are called option types. In some other functional languages, they've got different names. For instance, in Haskell, it's very funny, it's called maybe. So maybe it's got a value, maybe not, who knows. It's brilliant, I think. Anyway, so here it's an option type. Now, this syntax right here is how you initialize an option type that actually contains a value. So you call this sum function, which is like a little helper function to do with the option types in particular, and you pass it the value, in this case an int, right? Now let's have a quick look at the interactive environment. If I do this, I do sum of 5, for instance, like this, what I get is a thing that is called an int option. Well, it makes sense, right? Because that's what it is. You have to realize, though, that this syntax, int option, in F#, is basically exactly the same thing as an option of int. So this is a generic type, right? But F# has this syntactic extension that allows you to specify generic types the wrong way around, so to speak. It makes a lot of sense in my mind, to be honest, because basically if I've got a list of a string in C#, you can actually do this in F# as well, by the way. This syntax is totally valid in F#, it's just not very common to use. So if I've got a list of string in F#, I could call this a string list, right? Which makes a lot of sense. It's the same thing, okay? Same type that is being meant here. And if I've got, nested things, then I could do a list of int, maybe like this. This is going to be an int list in F#. Which makes sense. So that's basically the colloquial way of putting it, right? Which is very easy to read as well. But it's exactly the same as those generic types, and both syntaxes are valid. So, now my sum function returns me an int option because it says, all right, 5 is an int, so I've instantiated this thing. So basically we're working with a class instance now, okay? That is of type option of int, int option. So that's what that is. And the none value, on the other hand, is a generic option where, this tick A thing is a generic parameter in F#. All generic parameters always have this tick to distinguish them from any other parameters, right? So this is a tick A option as opposed to an int option. So basically the none value doesn't have a value, obviously, so it doesn't care which type it really has. On a very low level, by the way, for those experts in the room maybe, this is very different from how this works in C#, because in C# at runtime, you cannot really have any unresolved generic values. It's not possible. Once you've got an instance of something, the generic value always has to be resolved. right? If you've created generic instances through through reflection, for instance, you've noticed that. You always have to specify the types first, and then you can go and create an instance. You can't create an instance before you specify all the types. Not so in F#. I can have values like this none thing that have an unresolved generic type in them, which means that at runtime, these instances, really, can be cast to any compatible type. So the none value is compatible with the int option, but it's also compatible with the string option, for instance. In C# you would have to create two separate none values, so to speak, one for the string, one for the int, and probably for any other type as well, if you wanted to do the same thing, right? So that's a very technical difference. If you haven't understood that totally, I apologize, but I just thought it's interesting to mention for those of you who've been digging into those details, maybe. Now, that's what's happening here. So I've got these two values, option val and option val 2. One of them has a value, the other does not. Now, I've got this function check option val right here, which takes a parameter called O, and for the first time I'm using a type annotation here which says that O is in fact a tick A option. Now we've already seen this before. This means that I can take any option value basically, regardless of the generic type that is in there, and I look at whether or not this value has a value, so to speak. And if it does, then I'm going to say val is this here, is my value, accessing the object value right here, the option value, sorry. And otherwise I say I do not have a value. Right? So few other things in here as well. Of course, you see that the function is now broken around in several lines and so on. I'm using indentation, by the way, for the block structure of my function. That's what F# does by default. I mean, well, in the case of an if, it's quite obvious, right? Any function always has as a return value the result of the last statement that is being executed. Right? So if I've got these simple functions, let's just quickly scroll up here to show you this. Where are they, though? That's an interesting question. Oh, I've got all the functions down here. There we go. So I could break this round like this, right? That's the add function that we've seen a few times, and that would be just as valid. The last value in the function, and there could be more in between, right? Like this, more lines of code, maybe. The last statement is always the return value, right? Very simple system, really. Right, just for you to understand what's going on here. All right, so this is the check option value function. And the last thing I want to show you in here is this example here, which uses a so-called list comprehension. We're now combining a number of different things, and that's quite interesting to see, really. So what is this thing that we're looking at, right? We've got this sum of Mercedes thing in here, which is a string option. Right? It's a string option. So, well, someone could drive a car or not, probably, right? So Willie drives a Mercedes, Anna drives a Honda, and Pete doesn't have a car, right? Wonderful. Now, these things are tuples. So the tuple is basically of type string and string option. It's a combination of these two types. And then finally, I'm using those brackets around the outside, and those brackets are what makes this a list comprehension. It creates a list automatically. Similar stuff in C# with the initializers, right? Only you still have to say new list, and then you can use curly braces and put your data right in there in the initializer syntax in C# 3. But the list comprehensions don't even need the type specified explicitly. They just go, or they represent a type themselves, if you will. So this is a list type that is created in F#. List comprehensions are very common in functional languages in general. These languages have always realized that we do work with lists a lot. And most of them have a syntax similar to this, where you use some sort of a bracket or a brace or something to say this is a list, right? It actually also goes much further than this. I don't have enough time today, unfortunately, to show you, but you can create sequences by having actual instructions inside the brackets, you know, that basically create the elements on the fly, as opposed to just having the static data in there. So it goes a lot further. But this is a very simple example. Now, we're talking about a list. Oh, there's a question. I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead.
For example, the function that shell cars, why do you use parentheses instead of spaces?
I'm not at the function show cars yet. If you can wait just a second, I'm going to explain all that. I think there's no particular reason, though, to just quickly answer your question. I could have written this a different way. I just decided to have it like this for some reason. But I'm going to get to the function in a second. Now, I was just going to point out, we're looking at a list of tuples, and each of the tuples is made up of two types, and the first type is a string, the second is a string option. Now, let me show you this. If I just point at people here, oh, now the sliding mouse thing is a little hard here. Let me try to show you this. If I point at people here in code, IntelliSense comes up and says, all right, this thing is in fact a string star string option list. Brilliant, huh? Because that's exactly what it is, right? So even the IntelliSense support in F# has now inferred the type correctly from the data that I'm putting in there. It's quite amazing, isn't it? And if I actually go and put something in there that's not compatible, like maybe I've got an int in here or something, IntelliSense comes up and says, in this case, this expression has type int, but is used here with type string option. Great, that's right. I'm doing it wrong, right? And IntelliSense immediately figures out what I'm doing wrong. So that's quite amazing, really, the whole type inference system that is also supported by the Visual Studio integration itself, and not just by the compiler even. Now, on to show cards. So I guess your question was related to these parens right here that I have, around the list, right, like this. Okay, no difference whatsoever in this case, right? I was just having those parens in there, and I think probably it might have been because I was having a type annotation on the list earlier where you do need parens, and then I removed it and I left the parens where they are. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever in this case to have parens around this list parameter or not, right? So the other parens in here are quite interesting, and that's my last little example in here. So we've not seen the for loop yet, but you know it's quite obvious what it does. It's similar to a for each in C#. It iterates over a list, and this is the list that I'm getting passed in, of course. And it uses decomposition right here to basically, well, make several assumptions. This says, I know that my list is going to contain a tuple, because I'm using parens around the whole syntactic construct right there. And I also know that the tuple is going to contain two values. And I want the first value for each tuple to be assigned to the value name, and the second one to the value optional car. Okay, so that's what happens here. Several assumptions at the same time, and quite a lot of functionality, really. There's a question, please.
What if the input does not match that assumption?
Well, first, the compiler goes and uses the intelligence, right, from looking at the code to use type inference to create a type. So my show cars function, let me do that zooming thing again, my show cars function in the end, oh, I've got to get rid of the selection like this, there we go, is a function that takes a sequence of string times string option as its parameter type and returns a unit, so that is nothing, right? So the compiler infers those types, and so you cannot basically call the show cars function in the end with a parameter that is not a sequence of tuples of strings and string options, right? So once more, type inference takes care of all this. Now the reason why it actually infers the types of string correctly is even more complicated. Let's move on. The next thing is the match expression. So I'm matching the optional car value, which I know is a string option, right? I'm matching this thing with several different possibilities right here. Now, the match is somewhat similar to a switch or a case, a select statement, whichever language you come from, really. So that's what it basically does. It's a lot more powerful, though, because you can use all sorts of things for the match expressions that make it very powerful. In this case, anyway, I'm just basically comparing the value from optional car to these two possibilities right there. So this says, if this optional car thing is an option type, so basically the compiler again infers, given my values, that this optional car thing must be an option type, number one, right? So If this is actually some, so meaning it has a value, then the value itself is going to be decomposed into the char variable. If it otherwise does not have a name, okay, I get into this branch down here. And in both cases, I'm using this print output here to say, you know, this person drives this car, for instance. And I'm using those placeholders, percent S, in there. And the placeholders are in a chart are specific to the type that I'm using. So and they play a role in type inference. So if I was going to change, for instance, this placeholder right here, which is for the name, to a D, those of you who know C are familiar with that, I presume, right? Because the D is for an integer and S is for a string and so on. It's mostly the same in F sharp as well. Now, the D says this is an integer. So suddenly the type inference is confused, but it's not that confused because it puts a squiggly line under the other name and says, okay, in this case, you're actually outputting the name as a string. So which one is it, right? So even the format string is used for the type inference process. In this case, the error message says the type string is not compatible with any of the types byte, int, and so on, right? All the types that can be used with a percent D. Okay, so this is totally part of the type inference process, and that's in the end where, you know, assuming everything is correct like this, where the compiler gets the string types from. That's why it can infer that I'm working with a list of tuples of types string and string option. One of the more fascinating examples of type inference there. Please.
I just want to go one step back to the tuples. Is it possible also to have more values in there?
Yes, they can have arbitrary length, yes.
In the for list, can you also leave out the extra, if you only need the name and optional car and there's more in the list, can you just
Yes, well, you can use so-called placeholders, which are underscores. So it would, you know, maybe look like this, to say there are several other elements in there, but I'm ignoring those.
Okay, but you still need to type the right amount of...
Yes. You need to have the correct number of placeholders, or the correct number of overall parameters. Yes, that's right, yeah. Please. Okay, well, so the question is, what if my format string is part of a resource section, for instance? And the answer is, I have no idea. That's a very interesting question. I guess it should be possible, and I wouldn't be surprised if maybe that would be one of the Visual Studio integration tasks that Microsoft is doing for 2010. So it'll be interesting to see if it is in there, maybe even now. But of course, it should be possible. It's just an additional challenge, of course, to the F-sharp people, you know, because no other languages use format strings for type inference, but F-sharp does, so they'll have to find a way around that, I suppose. You can always, I mean, in the end, that's the easy answer. There's a placeholder, which is the capital A, I think it's for any or something like that, which basically says you can pass in any type, right? So if I do this, then I could have a format string that is compatible with whatever I pass in it. Of course, you lose the type inference functionality that way, right? So compromise. All right, I want to move on because I've only got a few minutes and I would like to say a few words about the object-oriented stuff at least. We've seen quite a lot of the functionality of F-sharp, I think. So important to see that there is also stuff in F-sharp that is just better than some of the object-oriented functionality we have in C#. For instance, I've listed a bunch of things here. We've got object expressions. Object expressions allow you to create new objects on the fly, new classes on the fly. You can do interface types, which means that you can instantiate an interface, basically. Has anyone ever stumbled across that function in Link? I think it's got something to do with sorting, where for some reason you suddenly need to pass in an iEquality comparer or something like that. So that function is just kind of weird in Link, right? Why didn't they use a lambda like they normally do, so I could just do it in line? suddenly they use an interface, and I have to go and create a class and with the implement the interface and then create an instance of the class and pass it in and so on. A lot of work in F#, not a problem. You just go and create an instance of the interface right away. Brilliant, right? So there's a lot of stuff in there. The other thing is composition strategies. You all know this general idea, you know, you should be using composition over implementation inheritance when you create class hierarchies, basically. Well, in C#, it's pretty hard to do. Of course, you can create some variables locally and call into those other objects and so on, but there is no syntactic support whatsoever for it. In F#, you can do this very, very easily. You can also go and maybe use a part of an implementation from another class and override the rest and that sort of thing. All sorts of really cool stuff in object-oriented programming in there. Of course, you can do all the things like implementation inheritance, for instance, that other languages give you as well. So no loss there, pretty much. There are some differences, like the way you specify visibility, for example, is different in F# from C#, but not going to go there today. Now, let me show you my little Windows Forms demo right here. And this is just an example of how you can use F# in conjunction with existing .NET libraries. First, I'm pulling in some namespaces with the Open System Windows Forms and so on up here. Then I've got a call into Windows API. You know, this is the normal thing that's always at the beginning of a Windows Forms application. I'm instantiating this form thing, which is the standard system Windows Forms form, right? And I'm passing in this parameter, which is actually an on-the-fly property initialization. So I'm setting the text property of the form to this string. Then I'm instantiating a button, and there's something interesting happening here because I'm setting the size, and the size itself is a class as well, but it doesn't have a new. Why not? Well, there's a slightly odd thing going on in F#, and I hope they're going to make up their minds about that before 2010 becomes available. Because what it is they've got this convention that you use the new operator in cases where the class in question implements iDisposable, which makes some sort of sense. So they want you to be explicit, right? If the class implements iDisposable, you have to use new. If it doesn't, you don't. So these are both constructor calls. I mean, the size as well as the above new form or so on, right? These are both constructor calls. But with the size, we don't use new because there's no iDisposable in the class. So that's the convention. A little weird in my book, but there you go. They just want you to be explicit. That's one of the main things in F#, really, overall. And now, pretty much the final thing is this here that we haven't seen so far. I'm using a lambda expression to, my screen is not wide enough right here, to say, hook this up to the event handler on my button. And lambda expressions, this is the keyword fun, short for function, right? Not for fun necessarily, although it can be fun, of course, to work with lambdas. I'm using a placeholder for the parameters, which is quite interesting. In this case, by the way, because I'm not decomposing them, I only have to use one placeholder for several parameters, because event handlers, as we know, get a sender and an event args parameters. I can just go ignore those, and then I call into message box show. And the final interesting thing here is this pipe into ignore in the end. Because in F#, ignoring a return value of a call is not something you normally do, right? And if you actually want to do it, like I want with the message box, because it gives me like a dialogue result or something like that, I do say, okay, ignore this please, helper function, ignore. Right, and then I just run the thing, and I can actually do this, and it should come up, maybe. Oh, there we go, right? Oh, this actually shows up in a command line window in the background as well, but I could change my project type, by the way, to get rid of that, right? So it doesn't have to be. So let's click here for wonderful things to happen, and a wonderful thing has just happened. Isn't that brilliant? Right, so very quick, very short example, but, you know, no ugly syntax in there. I actually hazard to say that in some cases it's a little more concise, a little shorter than what you get in C#. Certainly, if you create larger classes, it really tends to be. But some of the syntax that is in C# 4, like named and optional parameters and so on, have been around in F# for a long time. So that's what makes things quite concise and expressive, right? And that's pretty much all I want to say about this, I think. Functional programming, of course, important. Compatibility with the existing world of .NET as well. And I've got some resources in here. There are several books out about F-sharp if you're interested in that. Foundations of F-sharp is unfortunately not the most current book because it's been around for a while, but it's probably the best for a beginner. Maybe there's going to be a new edition. I don't know really, but you know, it would be about time, I think. And Expert F-sharp is very, very, you know, precise, but it's quite complicated to read. There's also F-sharp for scientists by now, other interesting stuff online as well. And if you're interested in the functional side of things, I'm going to be right here tomorrow at 4:30 and tell you more about that if you want to hear more about the functional side of programming in F-sharp. Otherwise, again, you know, please do contact me if you've got any questions. I'm writing this fascinating book about functional programming in C#, which is going to be available sometime later this year, I think. And you can also listen to my brilliant podcast if you want to. So enough of myself, but, you know, do contact me. Thanks for being here. Thank you.